everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you, with the Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. If you're a new listener, we talk about different things here on this program. We talk about things related to human functioning, and I have been talking about men. With me in the studio today, Roberta Atti. Need Roberta's help with this one.
Hi, Armand.
Exciting stuff, isn't it, Roberta? We're going over here.
Oh, I think so.
What we're talking about today is men and their relationship to pain, and how men's relationship to pain dictates most of men's behaviors, attitudes. Men bury emotional pain in their bodies, and the burnout occurs when men numb themselves in the quest of someone else's mission. You know, they kind of move away from themselves. Men repress a lot of emotional pain. They never learn to deal with it. They never learn to feel it. So we're going to go, and first let's review pain itself. Let's talk about pain. You know, if you think about human development, endorphins had a major role in the development of human beings. An endorphin, which is a hormone-like substance, helps you deal with pain by numbing you to the pain. That's the most way it works. There's two ways it works, isn't it, Roberta? Or is that just the primary?
Well, it does a number of things, but its primary function is to numb pain. And the remarkable aspect of these substances produced inside the body, Armand, is that they're almost identical to opiates extracted from the poppy that then we make morphine or heroin from. So what's remarkable is that the brain has a receptor for a substance produced by the brain itself and the central nervous system, and there's a substance out there which is almost identical.
And this, what it does for us, so we have to understand, is it helps us hold down our impulses. This is what's important. Pain and the response to pain, the endorphins, helps us hold down our impulses, thus permitting the storage and delay of responses until a future time. This, it means that time is left to contemplate, to foresee, to figure out, and above all, to abstract, to imagine responses, and to build a repertoire of reactions that allow us to be different from the direct stimulus response behaviors of animals.
Oh, that's so well explained, Armand, that's exactly what happens. And when someone is in a lot of pain, and if you give this person an opiate, that pain almost magically disappears, and the person is no longer aware, even at times, of what the source of the pain is.
And the purpose of it is to delay the response.
Mm.
You see, impulse is what happens to the lower animals. The other animals, and my apologies to any lower animals that may be listening, hearing me call them lower animals, but other animals who don't have the ability to hold back the impulse. You see, if they get pain, they just react to the pain unless they get their own endorphins. But usually they will respond. Humans have used endorphins to build this repertoire of responses. You know, we now have these different responses. So pain is important because pain is a signal that something is wrong, right?
Well, you know, Armand, there is a condition whereby a person is neurologically impaired in such a way that they're not able to feel any pain. You know that, right?
Alexithymia, yes.
And these people have to live in a bubble, because if they burn themselves, they don't know it. If they sit on a nail, they don't know it. They can't feel any pain. Now, that's life-threatening. So I think we should speak in favor of pain and say that it's definitely a very important survival tool that gives us feedback from the environment and how we're interacting with it.
And yet, what men are taught from an early age on is to avoid pain.
Or not show it.
And not show the reaction, not show the hurt.
But that's more important than not feeling it, I think.
Well, I'm not sure, because this is going to lead us to that discussion. We'll get there. The fact that endorphins are similar in action to that of almost injected morphine is kind of amazing. Almost any painkiller, tranquilizer, alcohol, or barbiturate shares the same mechanism to achieve the production of endorphins. Alcohol withdrawal can be treated by tranquilizers or even heroin, you know. I mean, it's just, it's all the same. Now, a Swedish pharmacologist, Lars Terenius, had discovered that patients suffering from emotional pain produced more endorphins than those suffering from physical pain. Emotional pain is real, and often more intense than physical pain.
This is a very important point, Armand, because have you heard so many times people who are in emotional pain who say that they've been told that they're imagining it and that it doesn't really exist and it's all in your head and just snap out of it and what are you dwelling in and just think of something else? Emotional pain is as real, if not more real, in the experience of it, as much as physical pain.
So grief and loss, despair, they could be excruciating, even more than physical pain, is according to what the studies are seeing, as kind of the response being from the human body. Now, what does this have to do with men? It has to do with the fact that men are taught from an early part of life not to feel emotional pain. Now, how are they taught not to feel it? They're taught that it's unmanly, number one, to show it. But number two, they are given over and over again, a man is given a sedative every time he feels pain. So if a man feels any kind of separation from his mother, for example, he goes running back to mommy, or he gets a food substitute, or he gets a cigarette or a drug. The main idea is men will not feel the emotional pain of separation. And this is the beginning of it. Now, think of tribal life, right? In the old tribes, when somebody was coming of age, what they would do is they would take that kid, and they would say to the kid, okay, now get out of the tribe, go in the jungle, you're going to spend 40 days in the jungle, or 17 days in the jungle, and go face yourself. Go through whatever you're going to go through. And the kid is not told not to cry, not told not to scream, not told what to do. They just put him there and say, go through it. Learn. You don't come running to your mama every minute. This young boy goes out to the jungle, and when he's seen other boys coming back from the jungle and coming back quite differently after this journey, not modern man, this doesn't happen to us.
Well, Armand, I think that the focus on individuality and individual achievement that is so prevalent in our society perhaps is behind all of this, in the sense that a man is supposed to not listen to his feelings because that would compromise his ability to establish himself successfully in society. And I think that by teaching men that this pain in reality does not exist, I think that what men are told is not to feel the pain, but the pain that you're feeling doesn't really exist. You're imagining
it. That's important.
And therefore, the men, I think, in their nervous system, what is learned is the ability to suppress, to repress the pain, not to make it go away, but to suppress it and to put it below a threshold of awareness so that it doesn't come up. And that's actually detrimental for the body-mind system.
For the entire system.
Because the pain doesn't go away.
Well, you see, here's further stuff we learned about studies. Many studies have come to the same conclusion. Active suffering, right? The active experience of pain, feeling it, increases survival, while repression of pain decreases it. Pain plus repression equals disease. That's what leads to the most disease. That's what leads to most cancer. It's pain felt and pain denied.
So experiencing the pain is then life supporting.
That's right.
In the sense.
And in a physical level, it is not just pain that makes us vulnerable to disease. It is pain plus repression. Now, this is the physiological factor. An experiment was done with rats in which their tails were pinched constantly. The rats became voracious eaters, and when not surprisingly, their endorphin levels rose initially, you know what I mean? So then, they were injected with naloxone, which is a thing that blocks the endorphins. They first acted as if they were in pain, then went into this withdrawal with this kind of wet dog shakes, then finally, the symptoms of overeating stopped. The symptom of overeating was reversed by Noxolone. Yet it never interfered with the actual pain. So, in other words, feeling the pain or denying the pain sent the person to compulsive eating, sent the rat over to overeating. And that's what happens to us. Current research indicates that anything that blunts pain, whether it be tranquilizers, anesthetics, endogenous painkillers, also blocks the immune system. And what is the greatest of all painkillers? Ideas. Thoughts. Things that we could do with our mind that block us from feeling pain.
It seems to me, Armand, that by blocking pain, what we're doing is we're turning off a very important communication channel between the body and the mind, that they're
it's
not separated.
Self, that's
but,
right.
And so, therefore, we're sort of not really in our body when we block pain. That's what I'm hearing you say, and that's what I understand this to be.
That, and this is,
and therefore, we're not responding appropriately to the stimulus that we're presented with.
And this, I think, is man's dilemma.
Right. And this could even be, perhaps, the reason why modern men seem to succumb younger than they should to, to the stress and to lowered immunity, let's say. It may very well be that this is one of the causes.
See, men bury emotional pain in their bodies, and the burnout comes because men have been taught to ignore psychological pain. The truth is that men have been taught by flawed people, by other men who have always done it, to go on the wrong painful mission and endure the wrong kind of pain. Yes, go out and lift weights and pain, no gain. Go get the physical pains in your bodies of development, but ignore that emotional pain. The problem of achieving manhood in any culture always leads us to the problem of pain. The healthy journey of manhood starts with a conscious choice to face the emotional pains of our life. The inner pain that comes with finding one's own unique mission. If you're afraid to feel it, how could you ever go there? If you're afraid to feel the pain of separation from your mother, from things you're dependent on, how much of a man could you be? If you can't let go, what do you say to yourself? Because you're not willing to face the pain, separation. Let me give an example. The first stage of becoming a grown-up is always separation. For thousands of years, men in their early teens were suddenly separated from that village. You know, they were thrown out. Now, the sudden separation was a very painful experience. The boy was exiled for an indeterminate amount of time. To an inhospitable place to face unknown challenges. Yet the boy knew from early in his life to expect this separation. He knew it was coming. Look at the Western man. Look at what happens to us. We never know of separation. Yes, eventually you'll move away from your mother and you'll get married. You know, you'll go find another mother. You'll eventually move out and you'll have your addictions. You'll have alcohol, drugs, and sex. And you'll have tobacco and you'll have food and you'll have all these other things. And that will entertain you and you'll never have to deal with the pain of separation. Well, dear friends, because we were conditioned this way, we have become addicts. Today, men often face a similar situation, forceful separation. Some are separated from their jobs by layoff or firing. How well do people do when they're laid off or fired? If they have never dealt with separation and pain of separation in their lives, as most men haven't, they are devastated by being laid off or being fired. But if they understand separation, if they've allowed themselves to separate, then they're not so attached to the job. Other men find themselves involuntarily in the pain of a divorce or the abrupt termination of a significant relationship. Some men are suddenly separated from a former lifestyle because of a serious illness or accident. How men handle accident, illness, death is once again related to that first thing they were never trained to separate. Are you one of those guys? Are you related to one of those guys? Are you a woman who's looking at somebody who, and you wonder, you say to yourself, he could never leave me. You know, he calls me up every minute. He wants to know where I am. He's always controlling me. What's that all about? It's this inability to be separated. This inability to face that pain.
But Armand, if a young boy is starting to feel this pain of separation, and he has not been given the tools, the information on how to deal with it, he's not even able to express it verbally because he doesn't have the vocabulary to express how he feels. He has been taught that men don't feel anything other than rage or lust. How is a boy supposed to deal with it other than repressing it? How is a boy, he can't go to his mother to cry at 14 or 15 years of age because that's no longer acceptable. He can't go to his friends for sure because they'll make a joke out of him. He's not going to find adult males that easily who are going to be willing to sit with him while he cries his eyes out for his mother. You know, because the adult male most likely is going to say, snap out of it. You're a big boy now. You don't need your mama anymore. So how is a boy going to deal with this? It seems to me that it's a strategy that's appropriate for the boy to numb himself and tell himself, I'm not really feeling this, and just keep putting it in the back and until it is forgotten. But then it surfaces as probably some kind of immune system disturbance. How would you teach these kids to express this pain?
Oh, I'd let them go through the pain with the appropriate support. I'd say, in other words, you know, you're going to be separate from this, and this is going to be painful, and I'd let them know about being separate. But you're right. I mean, in our world today, any of you out there, think of a painful experience you had. Somebody died. Do you remember going for the drink, saying, I think I'll go have a drink. I think I'll go get drunk. I think I'll go get stoned. I think I'll go get laid. All of these addictions are meant to take you away from feeling the pain of separation.
However, what you just said, Armand, that ideas are the most important vehicle of communication exchange, I would think that if we could give, as you said, if we could give an environment that supports these experiences, in other words, if we had adults who are able to be with these youngsters, wouldn't that allow for the pain to follow its natural cycle, to perhaps reach a peak and then eventually kind of dissolve?
Sure, because you're just facing your pain. You know, most men neither expect separation to ever happen, because they're always dealing against it, nor do they have any clue as to how to handle the pain. The pain is too hard to ignore or to bury. The pain is not the physical pain of a back-breaking job, or the pain of long work hours, or the pain of financial burden that men have been taught to endure. The confusing pain is not covered in the training manual. The confusing pain is the emotional pain. What do they do? Separation is always the first step in growing up, fellas. You gotta learn to deal with it. You gotta let it go and face the feeling, not numb yourself to the feeling. Don't meditate. Religions have for years given us, philosophical ideologies have given us ways of numbing ourselves. How does God allow young children to be tortured? You know, and then the church would say, that's God's way, you've got to believe in God. Hypnotize yourself so that you don't feel the pain of what you see around you. Hypnotize yourself. And that's what belief systems do. They get you to hypnotize yourself. That's what positive reinforcement does. It gets you to hypnotize yourself away from the pain. The truth is, for as long as man doesn't face his pain, man is going to always, always have to be an addict. Most men who come into my office are feeling two things. One is the kind and intensity of emotional pain that they've never felt before, like they're separated from somebody, and they've never felt they're separated from someone they love. And the other pain is this deep shame that they're feeling this pain at all. They're stuck on two counts. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about pain, and we're talking about the effect of pain on men. You know, that, what I'm saying to you is, my friends, that if we understand the level, the ordeal that men have in not being able to feel emotional pain, not being able to go through it, you begin to understand why they are so dysfunctional. We are constantly numbing ourselves. To feel pain means to actually go through the emotional part of it, not to block it, not to push it away.
Armand, it seems to me that the kind of pain that men are told they should not be feeling is mostly the pain involved with sadness, grief, loss. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that men perhaps learn to substitute one feeling for another, and that maybe when they start to feel this loss and grief and sadness, rather than to feel that, they would immediately switch over to rage or some kind of an emotion that would make them feel in charge, powerful, and able to affect their environment.
Yes,
right?
Actually, yes.
So a lot of rage could actually be a way of numbing oneself.
Well, rage is a way of numbing oneself, because blind rage, especially where you don't even know where you are anymore, you know, you don't feel anything. You're just screaming and yelling, and you're staying away from the hurt that's underneath it. It's such a difficult thing.
So when men experience a lot of rage and they think, oh, well, nothing's wrong with me, I can feel my feelings, because, see, I can easily express how I feel. But that's a cop-out.
Rage is not a feeling.
Okay. It's what would you call it?
Anger is a feeling.
Uh-huh.
Rage is an avoidance of a feeling.
Isn't that interesting?
And a rageful man is a man who's avoiding his pain. So when you look at somebody, and you look at somebody who is rageful, you know, you look at them in the way I do, and I say, oh, this poor kid,
yeah.
Such pain.
It's a temper tantrum, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Such pain. It is a temper tantrum.
I bet that little boys are told it's not okay to cry, but it's okay to be angry.
That's true. You
right?
know, Roberta, men are taught that it is okay to be angry, it's not okay to cry, so therefore they can use their anger as their way of expressing catharsis, getting through this feeling.
Yeah.
But again, the major thing that they're always complaining about is separation. If you had one pain that every man would talk about, if we were to break all of men's feelings down, we could say, break it down to one fear of one feeling, which is the fear of separation.
Mm.
He just doesn't want to be out of control. He doesn't want anything to leave him under any circumstances.
Mm.
And that's how he builds his life. Armand DeMille here with you with Roberta Atti. We're looking at men, and we're looking at men in pain, and we're not looking at them over there. I'm looking at us over here, you know.
Armand, I have a question based on what you just said. So could it be that men who are who avoid commitment as a life choice, you know, I'm not committing to anyone because that's just not me. Could it be that they're really repeating an attempt to separate? In other words, by not committing to any particular woman or person or relationship, could it be that then this is an attempt to separate by simply not even engaging?
Yes, and it may not even be, you mean a benign attempt. You mean an attempt to finally deal with it in some way?
An attempt to actually experience the separation but be in control of it.
Yeah, and which is not experiencing it.
I see.
Which is, again,
so
avoiding
it. So it's another cop-out.
So the womanizer and the guy who wants no relationship, you know, the guy who's afraid to be in a relationship for any length of time is never facing the pain.
Hmm.
Never facing it because he's going to avoid it. Our telephone number here is 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We are talking about the ordeal of growing up as a man, and we're talking about how it is important to acknowledge that this separation is such a difficult thing for men. The second broad step in the grown-up journey is submitting, you know, to ordeal, submission to the pain of change. You know, it's another form of separation.
And to the pain of not being in control of what another person is going to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Humility alone is a sign of hope that we're starting on a different path. So if you watch somebody, who is trying to grow, you'll often see that they feel beaten. And this idea of being beaten, instead of taking it away from them by numbing it and saying, oh, everything is going to be fine. Oh, you're going to do fine. Oh, you're a genius. You're going to do fine. Instead of numbing it, we would give them the greatest gift if we were to say, oh, great, you're going through that right now. Please go through that the most. Take that on. Take that realization on. I heard someone the other day talk about his fear of being alone. So I said, imagine you're alone right now. Be alone. You don't even have to imagine it. You're just here in an office with me. Be alone now. And he said, I can't be alone now. He said, why? I said, why? He said, because it's scary. Yes, it's scary. Do it here. Do it now. Do it in my office. And I watched him go through this awareness that he is truly alone. And I watched his entire body start to change as he went from being a guy who was sitting in a kind of a lackadaisical way to a guy who was terrified. And he tightened up his entire body, screaming, I'm alone, I'm alone, I'm alone, until he felt the pain of that aloneness. Well, why is alone painful? Alone itself is not painful, but alone is painful if you've never let yourself feel it. And so he did. And so he did, and it may have taken 20 minutes of the experience of going through it, because when he came out of it, he was so much freer. And he knew, you know, it's not a feeling I have to avoid. It's a feeling I may have to feel again in my life. People may leave me. I may wind up being alone all over again. But once you get the attitude that you could survive it, things change. Things change a great deal. Once you know you can survive separation, then things are very different. Now, this is not true from somebody who never feels attachment. If you're a guy who never gets attached, then your job is not to feel separation. You know?
Wouldn't that be an attempt on the part of the little boy to control mom, in the sense, like, if I don't need you and I don't need to come near you, I'm in control. You're not. So therefore, you're not going to leave me because I've already left you.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
I've left you. I'm going to leave you and I'll never be at your mercy.
And so that means that actually that boy has never left mom.
Here's something I wanted to read from one of these articles. It said, subjectively, the person may believe that he's in agony, just like those ideas make him feel a little bit better. The person who utters soothing words is usually liked and admired. He becomes the fix. So if somebody comes along and they're really nice to you, oh, you're really fine, you're really well, he's saying to you, don't go through your pain. The person who hands you the tissue is that's your narcotic. One can become addicted to that person in exactly the same way that one becomes addicted to any substance that effectively kills pain. So if you have somebody who gives you occasional niceness, you can easily become addicted to them. Think about somebody you're addicted to. Think about it. I could think of somebody, right? Somebody you're addicted to. And just imagine, what is it that keeps bringing you back there? They help you kill the pain. They help you not feel the pain. What if instead you let yourself face the pain? What if instead of saying, I am going to just kill the pain of this time I have alone, or kill the pain of this thing that I'm going through, what if I just let myself feel my aloneness instead? What do you think would happen? Armand DeMille here with you with Roberta Atti. We're going to be taking a very short break. Consider it, my friends. Then we're going to be taking your calls. We're going to be hearing from some of you wonderful guys who have been writing me letters. Here's a little extra something for you. Here we go. That's a little relaxing for the guys out there who are willing to take it on. WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. It's 1:30. 1958 recording from the Blackhawk in San Francisco, I believe. Cal Jader and Al McGibbon. Interesting music, yeah? Vince Guaraldi. Just bring you something different. Hey, you know, there's a thing called sacred pain, hurting the body for the sake of the soul. If you think of religious martyrdom, monastic denial, and self-flagellation, rites of passage among tribes, from Africa to the Americas, the austere, barefoot pilgrimages across South Asia, there is something. Why would anybody invite flogging, crucifixion, sleeping on spikes, hanging suspended by the hooks in one's flesh, or walking away across miles of scorching desert with bare, bleeding feet? Why do people do that? Why do you think people do it? Do you think it's for the pain experience and for the endorphin experience? Or do you think it's for some part of us that is trying to remind us that the role of pain, before it was displaced, is rich and nuanced? Here's what Gulgik, an author, said. He said, the role of pain before it was displaced was to recognize this fact as a direct legacy of the 19th century medicalization of pain and elevation of nervous disorders. He said, since we have started to numb our pain, we've gotten sicker and sicker and sicker. And almost any numbing substance, pain-numbing substance, in a way helps encourage cancer and stops healing.
Well, we do know that painkillers suppress the activity of natural killer cells, which are very important cells.
Talk about the killer cells.
Well, these are cells that are in charge of destroying cancer cells or unwanted microorganisms in the body. So when the body is undergoing a challenge of that sort, like a cancer or an infection, the immune system immediately will increase production of these natural killer cells, Armand. But then if we take morphine, then these cells are kind of go back to sleep. And therefore, whatever they were supposed to do, they're not going to be doing. So this is very important. But this is why we give strong medicine for pain only to the terminal patients, because we don't want to give this medicine to people who still have a chance to recover, you see. But if it is believed that there's no recovery possible, then numbing the pain would be the goal of dealing with the disease, just to make the person as comfortable as we can. But doctors are very aware that once they put a patient on morphine, his or her natural immunity is going to kind of go to sleep.
I can't tell you the number of people I have known who have screamed at their doctors, take the pain away, give me anything, take the pain away. And the doctor is always limiting the drugs, and you wonder why. You know, why does the doctor not give you, codeine? And why doesn't he not automatically give you all these drugs that will take your pain away? Why does he say take aspirin? Why does the doctor hold back? And it's part of what you're saying. I think there is not just they're afraid they're going to get in trouble or you're going to get addicted or misuse the drugs, but I think they know the minute I start you on the serious regimen of pain killing, then I am going to say to you, your body is going through its own death. See, yeah. If I take away, so it is better, my friends, if you go through pain, if you're going through a physical pain in your body, facing that pain will give you a much better chance of staying alive than numbing that pain. Because even though you kill the pain, you kill the body's natural immune system. Now what do? So here you are in agony, and now we'll talk about emotional agony. Facing the emotional agony, going through it, no matter what you've got to do, go through it, friends, because if you don't go through it, you're going to have to pay the dues later. The more you numb yourself to your emotional pain, the shorter your life is going to be, the more sick you're going to get later on.
Also, Armand, the more you numb yourself, the more endorphin receptors are going to show up on your cell membranes. You see, because they say that you're a young boy and you learn to suppress your pain as we described earlier. What you're doing is you're teaching your body to produce these numbing substances in excess on a chronic basis all the time in order to keep the pain at bay. So that means that your body's going to have to adjust to a higher level of endorphins. And that means that the cells are going to have more receptors to accommodate more of this stuff. Well, guess what? Then if at any time you start to decrease production of endorphins, the pain is going to come back, except this time is going to come back intensified because now you have more receptors, which means you're hungrier for painkillers. See, this is something that happens. So now this is how addictions set in.
And painkillers, mind you, are not just the drugs. A painkiller could be going to a topless strip bar.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
You know what I mean? You're going there.
Calling a 900 number.
You know, sex addiction.
Sex is a big one.
Or if not even sex, just make me feel something, because that's what eventually happens to men. Men go through life numb from quelling their own pain so much that eventually they're begging to feel something.
Like throwing oneself off of a plane just for the thrill of
right.
it.
Right, bungee jumping.
Yeah,
just
that's the name.
Maybe
right.
I'll feel something, you know
right.
what I mean? Or skydiving.
Or exercising to the point of self-abuse.
So I could feel something. Or getting in love, falling in love with a kind of person that's absolutely going to make you feel pain. You see, you pick
oh,
the person.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Sure, you pick the person who's going to make you feel something. You get a numb. If you're numb, you're going to pick the wildest, craziest person, because that person maybe will spark the life into you.
Wow.
212-209-2900. We are going to take some calls today. This is Armand DeMille talking to you about men and their relationship to pain and how I believe that what a man can do is to face his emotional pain is probably his best solution for how to go from boyhood to manhood. If you look at the man show on cable TV, what you see is men, boys, numbing themselves. They're numbing themselves with the dancing girls, with the drinking the beer, with the getting off on one thing or another, and the camaraderie of let's not feel it, let's not feel it.
Mm.
And okay, that's...
But that's a ticket to disease.
And it's a ticket to boyland.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
but
you
if you're
really,
talking
yeah.
about getting to that level of manhood where you feel like you're the kind of person that would really be willing to accept and really embrace a true love, you've got to be somebody who is willing to separate and face their own emotional pain. That's it. We got to take some calls. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. I'll take a call right now. Thanks for standing by. Hello there.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Armand. This is Noma. I spoke to you once before.
Hello,
a couple
Noma.
Months ago. But listening to your program, it hits my life on the head. I have a 17-year-old son, and he's fighting the attachment, not to meet his mother, but to his father. When I had him, I went back to work when he was 6 months, and, you know, the breast milk, his father would give it to him, and his father worked at night. When we separated and divorced, he wanted to go and live with his dad. He lived with his dad for 4 years. Then he started acting like a teenager. I think it was the summer of the eighth grade. He was getting ready to go to the eighth grade. When he came to visit me for the summer, his father calls me in September, in August, and tells me he doesn't want him to come back. He wants him to stay with me. My son has been going through hell since then. Now at 17, he's going towards gangs. And I don't want to make him a ward of the court. I don't know what to do with him. I'm at a loss, but I know the boy is in such pain.
And I fully understand your dilemma and your predicament. Because the truth of it is, he needs to go through the pain of it. Which means to go through the pain of what he feels with his father. He's not going to do it in the gangs because the gangs are going to toughen him up. And he's not going to do it if you bail him out. He's not
going to
do it.
But he's not going through it.
Yeah, I know. That's the trouble, is he's not going to go through it. And so that's why I understand your dilemma. Your dilemma as a mother is you're saying, boy, I wish I could get him to deal with his stuff. But you can't help him deal with his stuff. He's got to get there somehow. By now, it's too far gone. How's he going to get there? How's he going to get conscious?
I have an idea, because I have a 15-year-old son, and, you know, I have similar predicaments that I have to deal with. And I have found that what works best is not so much for me to try to help him. In fact, that does not work at all. But to provide him with the company of adult males who can reach across the, you know, the bridge, and who can communicate with him and who have been through the process, that seems to work really well, much better than anything else I could think of.
Well, I have a problem with that because I have no man in my life. He has a 33-year-old brother, but he lives in Los Angeles, so he doesn't get to see him very often. Right now, I sent him to Seattle to spend 2 weeks with his sister. But he's going to be coming home eventually. He's joined the Marines, but the trick is trying to get him through this last year of high school.
You might have
to go to boot camp.
I understand. You might just have to let it go. I don't know if there's going to be a solution for it. Because maybe somewhere in high school or somewhere in boot camp he's going to meet somebody, you know, who's going to be at least enough of a buddy to him. But I hear your position. I don't know what the solution is. He would not be responsive to therapy. He would not be willing to see a counselor. If he's willing to see a counselor, it would make all the difference.
He is seeing a counselor for drug and alcohol.
So that may be real helpful. And then what you've got, if you got the groups, Narcotics Anonymous groups, would be terrific for somebody like him.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? If he is got a drug and alcohol problem.
Because there are some men who have been through the experience of pain and separation and can guide him.
But you mean he would have to be in a group with men, because the group he's with is his peers?
Yeah, but even in that, but I would also suggest you go to some of the older ones, too.
There are men's meetings where you can get all ages. You know, in a meeting you can get an age range, you know, from 15 to 85.
And this is not to discount the kind of pressure that you and all parents feel. I've got to let go of the call right now. Thank you for calling in. You see, one of the things that happened is there you become the protective mother and you want to save the child from going through their pain. And even if your idea is, what I want him to kind of go through it, you can't save the child. That's the problem. The child is so used to being saved by a narcotic of a mother, by the narcotic of mothering, that he just goes to substitute narcotics. It's a real difficulty. It's a problem. 212-209-2900. Let's hear from another caller. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Armand.
Hello there.
I was listening to your description of sort of the young boys who would self-medicate themselves, but numb themselves.
Yeah.
And it was just dead on. I saw myself in that completely. I'm 28 years old. And I've been doing that for quite a while, and it was a combination of pornography and a lot of intense physical activity, different sports and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I also have sort of a scientific background, so I understand the downregulation or upregulation of the endorphin receptors.
Sure.
But my question is, what at this point? I mean, it's reasonable to conclude that the neurochemistry is a little different, or the sort of receptor is a little different. What can you do?
Well, they are. Let's think about your original separations. Let's go back to it. Let's talk about your relationship to your mom. Let's start with that.
Right. Well, it was, that wasn't great. It wasn't a bad thing. She was working two jobs, so she worked at nights a lot. She wasn't always readily available. I was the youngest in the family, so, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of attention to go around. And I actually kind of bonded with my sister, and she became more of a mother figure. And then she was much older than me, and she went away to college probably when I was about 10 years old. So that was more of a separation problem than anything else. But, I mean, there were, without getting into all the details, there were other additional factors in my childhood. I had a brother who was pretty psychologically abusive. You know, there were other difficult situations.
So and how often?
Identifying the pain, I can identify the pain. I mean, I can identify where it came from.
Well, when you identify the pain, do you let yourself go through it, or do you just look at it intellectually and say, I understand it?
You know, I look at it intellectually and say, the last time that I allowed myself to feel the pain, talk about a decrease in your immune system. I was also going through graduate school at the time, so I was very busy. But the last time I allowed myself to feel the pain, I ended up in a health clinic, and my immune system had dropped to the point where the physician who was examining me suggested that I get a test for HIV because I was showing symptoms of a full-blown AIDS patient.
Isn't that something?
Because going through that level of depression and that level of sort of emotional pain, my immune system was destroyed.
Well, yeah, so, and it's kind of the opposite. Your immune system was already destroyed, and when
it was like a tune-up.
Yeah,
so, that's how I would look at that. That's a crisis that could be called. I mean, I don't know the details. I can't really say, but it could very well be that a crisis like that is not actually destructive, but the opposite. You could actually be reaching down into a part of yourself that you have not reached into before, and from the outside it looks like you're dying, and maybe in a sense, as a metaphor, you may be dying to an old self that you no longer fit in, and you're trying to grow. So your body's going through this ordeal, and from a medical perspective, it can look like a disaster, but it doesn't have to be a disaster if you can recognize what the body's actually doing. See, but the problem is in medicine, we don't look at the body as a body-mind continuum. We just look at the body.
Right.
So whenever there's a symptom, we assume pathology. It could very well be that it's the opposite.
Could you, do you have a counselor who could help guide you through the bottom of it?
It would be a great thing. I'm a graduate student. I'm acquiring a PhD. So at the time, I don't have medical benefits, and I don't have the types of things. At some point, once I finish, which I hope to be fairly soon, you know, I probably will seek counsel. But at this point right now, and up until this point financially, it just hasn't been an option.
There are a couple of books I could recommend. If you really wanted to look at it, there are two books, and I know everybody's going to be calling my office once I mention this. There's a book called Making Sense Out of Suffering, by a man named Stedbacher, Stedbacher.
Okay.
And there's another book, a more recent one, that is by Arthur Janov, Janov. He's a guy who wrote the book on primal therapy. He's got a recent book. I don't know the name of it, but I...
And what's the name? The spelling again? I'm sorry.
Janov. Janov. And I think the book is called Prisoners of Pain.
Right.
No idea. Prisoners.
And with the endorphins, as I said, my question now is, you know, even when I recognize these things, I also recognize that, you know, I walk through the day in sort of with a constant kind of hunger for those endorphins, for that fix, whether it be through exercise or, as I said, through, you know, sex or pornography. And it's like walking around as a junkie. I can imagine it's much, much less intense. But you always have that craving, you always have that need, and that's pretty much how my days go. You know, I'm always...
And you're aware of it.
Doing
it. And being aware of it is a big step. Being aware of it is a big, big step, especially at your age. You know, you've got a lot of it beat.
At this point, how do you manage that? I mean, is there anything besides the intense physical exercise that I can do to sort of satisfy that or to you know, how can I sort of get rid of that craving?
It's not to get rid of it. It's to face the craving. You see, this is the difficult thing. The way you go through any addiction is to face the addiction. Now, these are words. There are words that are going to go on deaf ears. You know, a lot of people out there are going to say, oh, yeah, you know. But the idea of it is you have the craving and you don't satisfy it and you find out you'll survive. You have the addiction and you don't feed it and you find out you're going to survive. The pain that's underneath it is nowhere nearly as big as the pain that we would anticipate. You see? Right. So it's really, if you want to do the work, right. is to face the pain, the emotional pain, and then sometimes even the physical pain of separation. You know, the physical pain that goes when you don't feed even a sugar addiction.
Right. Yeah. So just when that hunger comes,
just let yourself go through it. And it's going to mean shaking. It's going to mean nervousness. It's going to mean anxiety. It's going to mean tension. And you just go through it. And you don't buy the things in your mind that tell you, oh, you know, you're going to get out of this. And, oh, you're going to feel better. Oh, just believe in Jesus. Or, you know, none of that to make yourself feel better. Go through the worst of it. If you dare face the pain, right, then you're going to be done with it. And that's the way it works. You know, it happened to me recently. I forgot what it was that I was going to feel. So something happened to my body with something broke or bent or something. Oh, I remember. I was going to a dentist, and I remember, I think I told the story recently on air. I was going to the dentist, and I was going to come in and do a radio program right afterwards. And the dentist said, oh, I've got to do some really deep work in here. I've got to give you Novocaine. And I said, you can't give me Novocaine because I can't speak on radio if you put Novocaine in my lip. And she said, well, do you want me to come back for another time? I said, no, do the work. I'll feel the pain.
Right. I'm very, very adept at dealing with the physical pain.
And not blocking the pain.
Yeah,
feeling
the pain. Sort of letting it wash over you.
But there was a problem. Exactly, letting it wash over you. That's the answer. And what happened was, unfortunately, the poor dentist said, I can't treat you this way. I can't treat somebody who's feeling pain. I said, you mean I got to make believe I'm not feeling the pain for your benefit? She said, yes, because if I see you wincing in pain, then I can't possibly take care of you.
Right.
Yeah, but you've got the idea of how to let it wash over you, not to make it disappear, but to feel it.
At some point, I definitely, you know, I will seek some counsel because it's pretty obvious that it affects, you know, my interpersonal relationships and all of those different types of things. And I've sort of tried to take steps to feeling. There was an impasse where I was at a threshold where I was either going to numb myself completely or, you know, go through what it was I was going through at the time, and I decided to go through it. So, you know, there is that hope. But, okay, well, I will give it my best
shot.
Well,
let me ask you just one more question before you go.
By all means, sure.
In your love relationships, what do you hope for?
You know, it's a very good question. I want, really what I'm looking for, and it probably extends to love relationships, but in my life, my whole goal is to achieve some level of peace. If I'm with someone, I want them to be supportive and loving, and I don't gravitate towards the drama. I don't gravitate towards the people who are trouble and hurtful and this and that. And unfortunately, I probably should accept a little bit more of the drama. But I'm really just looking for, I guess, kind of companionship. And again, but my primary goal, my motivation for everything is just achieve a level of peace.
To find it somewhere on the inside, including in your relationship, right?
Yeah, yeah. And anything that I identify as something that could possibly disrupt that, you know, in a day. And I really haven't had that many, you know, steady relationships. So, you know, there's all kinds of issues there.
Well, you may have to get involved in the disruptive ones so you could find out what it is you're avoiding there. You know what I mean?
Right.
Let them disrupt you a little bit.
Right. Well, I'm sure it's the emotional. Yeah, I'm sure it's the emotions
that you don't
want to
face.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes you got to throw away the oars, you know, and you just let the boat spin around and see where it's going to take you. Hey, what's your name?
The Scary Proposition. My name is Rob.
Robin? Did you say Robin or Robert?
Robert.
Robert. Robert, thank you for calling in, and thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
Take care.
This is Armand DeMille. Roberta Atti, once again, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Armand.
Such fascinating stuff we're uncovering about pain, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to do more about this. Hey, this is Armand DeMille. If you wanted a copy of today's show, you'd call 1-800-575-0580. 1-800-575-0580. These are people who reproduce and charge for their reproductions, just to let you know. 1-800-575-0580. If you wanted to get in touch with me, email me, Armand@brainlink.com. rainlink.com. Bye-bye for now.